Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Seniors Advocate News Conference Call. I would like to introduce Isabel McKenzie. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Frederick, and good morning to everybody. And thank you for joining the Office of the Seniors Advocate News Conference for the posting of our 2018 BC Residential Care Quick Facts Directory. As you know, I will be using PowerPoint slides as part of this presentation, and I want to make sure that everybody on the phone line is aware of how they can follow along. So a copy of a summary report about the information in the directory is attached to our website along with the slide presentation. So I would ask you, if you've not already done so, to go to www.seniorsadvocatebc.ca. I repeat, seniorsadvocatebc.ca. You will see an icon called Reports and Publications on the lower left side homepage of the website, and you're going to click on BC Residential Care Facilities Quick Facts Directory 2018. So just to repeat, you're going to go to Reports and Publications. You are going to click on BC Residential Care Facilities Quick Facts Directory 2018. And then you're going to see View PowerPoint Presentation as a link. I would ask you to click on that link, and I will give everybody a moment to ensure they're able to be logged on to the presentation. Okay, hopefully everybody has the presentation in front of you, and I will say when it is time to advance to the next slide. My presentation this morning will be about 20 minutes or so, and then the floor will be open to questions. I am aware there are media on the line, and I am aware that there are deadlines to be met, so questions will be taken first from the media and then open to everybody else. Just a reminder for those who've done this before and information for those who are new to this, if you have a question at any time during this presentation, you can put yourself in the queue to ask a question by pressing the number 0 and then 1. You press 0 and then 1. And if you no longer want to ask the question, just press the number sign, the hashtag sign. If you are media, please inform them that you are media and you will be queued first. Our phone agent, Frederick, who you've met this morning, will manage all the questions online. And just a reminder, the conference is being recorded. The recording will be updated onto the website in the next day or so. So thank you very much. So let's begin. First, I would ask you to move to the first slide, which is labeled About the Directory. So the Quick Facts Directory presents standardized information on 293 publicly subsidized residential care facilities in BC who care for about 28,000 seniors at any one time and about 40,000 a year. Information in the directory includes bed configuration, how many single rooms there are, how many publicly funded beds versus privately funded beds there are in each facility, whether the food is prepared on site or contracted out. For the first time, we're adding the funded food costs per facility. We look at the quality indicators provided by the health authority and by the Canadian Institute for Health Information on things like licensing inspection infractions, complaints, falls, adverse events, percentage of residents on antipsychotics, antidepressants, access to therapies, whether parking is provided for free, whether cable is provided, a whole variety of things are included for every facility, along with the number of funded care hours for each facility. most of you know, this is the third edition. This directory is updated in January of each year, and the information in the directory is current to the end of the previous fiscal year, unless otherwise noted. New to the directory this year is a link to the residential care survey for each facility. So the opinions of the 20,000 residents and caregivers that we were able to gather through our residential care survey has now been posted. The facility level results have been linked to each facility. And so when you go on to look at all of this information about a facility, you can also hit the link and find out what the people living there think about that facility as well. And I would encourage people to do that. Next slide. So as we analyze the systemic information in the directory, what do we find? Well, let's talk about the facilities themselves for a minute. In British Columbia, we have 110 facilities that have 8,814 beds that are both owned and operated by health authorities. So they are staffed by the health authority staff, and they are considered in the core budget of the health authority. We have 183 facilities with 18,328 beds that are contracted out. So they're still publicly funded. The health authorities hold a contract with the operator of that facility for a certain number of beds. About 100 facilities have a combination of public and private beds, and the other 80-odd are 100% publicly subsidized beds. And contracted providers can be either a not-for-profit, either a denominational not-for-profit or a community-based not-for-profit, or they can be a private company. 73% of residents in care actually live in a single occupancy room. 87% of the rooms are single occupancy, 9% are double occupancy, and 4% are multi-bed, which could be three or more. The reason why the percentage is lower of residents who live in single occupancy rooms than the number of occupancy rooms is because the total number of residents is increased in the double and multi-occupancy rooms. In our health authority owned and operated facilities, 54% of residents are in single occupancy rooms, and in the contracted facilities, 82% of residents are in single occupancy rooms. Part of that reflects the fact that the contracted facilities, for the most part, are newer than health authority owned and operated, and certainly for the last number of years, the guidelines for new construction of care facilities has been single room with ensuite bath. There are differences between contracted and health authority owned and operated facilities, not just in the room configuration, but also in client complexity, funded care hours, reported incidents, substantiated complaints, and the use of therapies. And where there's a statistically significant difference, we have tried to highlight that in our commentary on the directory. Next slide, please. So who is living in these care facilities? What do we know about the residents that we have highlighted in the directory this year? We've added some new indicators. This has come from feedback from operators. And so we've indicated the average age of residents in a care facility. So in BC, it's 85 years. This has slowly been creeping up over the years. 59%, so more than half, are actually older than 85. And 5% are younger than 65. These will be people oftentimes with MS, ALS, acquired brain injury, paraplegics and quadriplegics from motor vehicle accidents, and of course there are some early onset dementia clients as well. We do find that the health authority owned and operated sites do on average have a higher percentage of younger people, and this is because they tend to have more complex medical needs, vent dependent, quadriplegia, etc. in the younger population. In the cognitive profile, 30% of our residents have severe cognitive impairment, and we have chosen the CHI-HI indicator of 4% on the CPS score or higher to indicate severe cognitive impairment. This is slightly higher in health authority-owned and operated facilities than in contracted facilities. 51% of our residents have mild to moderate impairments, so you could argue that this is a population that could live in the community with supports if that was their only condition, certainly at the mild end. And 19% of our residents have no cognitive impairments at all in our care facilities. Physical profile, what about their physical abilities and disabilities? 30% of our residents in care are almost completely or completely dependent on the activities of daily living, which means they have an ADL score of 5+. And this is distinctly higher in our health authority-owned and operated sites than in our contracted sites. Next slide, please. What about the social engagement of residents? This year, we have added data on the indicators of social engagement, the ISE score from the RI. This was actually at the recommendation of a number of recreational therapists about we should be starting to measure and report on this. It's not a perfect measurement tool. I know that moving to the revised indicators of social engagement, the RISE, is the new standard, but not all facilities are there yet, and so we've used the measurement we have that's going to give us the best overall picture we can get at this time. So for those of you who are unaware, the index of social engagement, which we do assess through our quarterly updates of assessment of our residents in care facilities, measures on a 7-point scale the assessment of the resident around their ease of interacting with others, whether they can pursue involvement in the life of the facility, whether they are accepting of invitations into group activities, are they at ease doing planned or structured activities, do they establish own goals, and how are they at self-initiated activities. And they are rated on this scale from 0 to 7, 0 being lowest function and 7 being highest function. So it's a little bit different from our CPS and ADL scale. What we found is that almost half of residents had a low sense of social engagement. They scored 0 to 2 on the ISE, and that was basically the same. There was about a 1% difference between ownership types. So whether you're in a contracted facility or health authority, it didn't make much difference. And what remains to be seen is how much can we move the needle on that number to make to improve social engagement with our activities versus looking at the conditions that will limit the ability of some people to have good social engagement. But when you look at 30% with severe cognitive impairment, but almost 50% with low ISE, you have to say, I think there is some room for improvement there. And hopefully now that we've started to measure it, we can start to look at the issue and see some improvement there. Next slide, please. Where are we with direct care hours? A very topical issue at the moment. And I think everybody probably knows this, but I just want to clarify again. Direct care hours are what is funded by the health authority to a facility. So facilities, particularly our contracted facilities, are not making the decision about how many direct care hours to provide. They are negotiating that with the health authority, and they are being funded for a certain number. And that's what these data indicate. So in BC, on average, 3.14 hours of care per resident per day. We know that guidelines indicate best practice is 3.36 hours per day per resident. So we are falling short of that on a system-wide basis in the province. For the 16-17 fiscal year, 15% of facilities meet the provincial guideline of 3.36 hours. This is a 6% improvement over last year when only 9% were meeting it. But I think we have to agree we're not going to take a lot of heart from this improvement, given that we still have 85% of our facilities not meeting the recommended guidelines. There is actually quite a big difference between contracted facilities and health authority owned and operated on the funded care hours. Contracted facilities have an average of 3.01 direct care hours, and 96% of contracted facilities are falling below the 3.36 direct care hours. Health authority owned and operated facilities are funded for an average of 3.35 direct care hours, and 67% of their facilities are falling below 3.36 direct care hours. Now, it is true, health authority owned and operated are caring for more complex clients than contracted facilities, but I think we can all agree that probably some of the more immediate remediation on these hours needs to be focused on contracted providers. Next slide, please. On a good news, bad news front, antipsychotic use, we continue to see a decrease, which is a very good thing. So the percentage of residents taking antipsychotics without a diagnosis of psychosis is 25%, and this represents a 7% decrease from 2015-16. So we are definitely, and you can see that this is part of a three-year trend, so we are definitely moving in the right direction. The bad news is that British Columbia still is one of the highest users of antipsychotics without a diagnosis of psychosis. We are still significantly higher than Alberta, Manitoba, and even Ontario. So we need to continue to focus on this, and more work can be done. Next slide, please. Antidepressants, which I do want to start to bring into the discussion, much like we did antipsychotics, because we're not seeing the needle move on this, and we are seeing effectively half of our residents on antidepressants, but only a quarter of them are actually diagnosed with depression. And so I know from practice in my previous life, we do use antidepressants for other issues, but I think that is the point we are starting to realize, is maybe we need to be paying more careful attention to what we're using our pharmacological interventions for, where we might be able to look at other interventions. And I think we need to start a discussion on antidepressants as well. Next slide, please. Again, on the good news front, daily physical restraints continues to decline. 8% of residents have daily physical restraints, and that's an 11% decrease from 2015-2016. Part of this trajectory of decreases is related to better understanding of how to code in RAI, particularly around the use of seatbelts in wheelchairs, which does not constitute a physical restraint. And I know that some facilities, there were some issues with not completely understanding how to code the physical restraint. But I think we are seeing the trajectory move in the right direction on daily physical restraints. And it is a quality indicator from CIHI. Next slide, please. Access to therapy, a bit of a mixed bag here. On a three-year trend line, we're seeing recreation therapy continue to rise. That's a very good thing. Recreation therapy is arguably what most residents can benefit from and should be receiving. Physical therapy and occupational therapy, we're not seeing that growth, and we're seeing potentially a little decline on physical therapy, occupational therapy holding its own. Now, every resident isn't going to necessarily need occupational therapy, and they certainly aren't going to need it necessarily every week, which is how we measure this. And the same could be said of physical therapy, although I think most of us would recognize more residents would need physical therapy more often than occupational therapy. And there is overlap between the disciplines as well, I think, certainly in the facility level. Next slide, please. On our incidents, there were a total of 4,629 reportable incidents in 16-17. The number of incidents is slightly higher than 15-16, but the rate is arguably the same, even a slight decrease. It's gone down by point one. So you have to express this as a rate per 100 beds, just simply because different facilities are different sizes, and the number of incidents relates to how many opportunities there are, and that relates to how many beds there are. So the rate this year is 17.4 per 100 beds, and it was 17.5 last year. So the rate's gone down. The reason the number went up is because we added 406 beds to the system this year. So on a greater number of beds, we're seeing a lower rate. The rate of reportable incidents is 24% higher in contracted facilities than health authority owned and operated. Next slide, please. Substantiated complaints. So just to contrast, a reportable incident goes to licensing. There's criteria for that, and there is compulsory reporting of certain incidents, and that's what drives the incident reporting. Complaints can come from a resident. They can come from a family member. They can arguably even come from a staff member, and they go through the patient quality office in the health authorities where the facility is located. And the number of substantiated complaints is actually quite low, and we measure this per 1,000 beds, not per 100, which gives you an indication of how low the rate of complaints are. So 181 substantiated complaints in 2016-17, and that's 13% lower than the year before. It decreased from 7.9 per 1,000 beds to 6.8. Now, there is quite a difference between health authority and contracted, but I would caution it is a difference on a very, very, very small number. So it's substantiated complaints are 1.6 per 1,000 beds in health authority and 8.9 per 1,000 beds in contracted facilities, which sounds a dramatic 356% higher, but I would caution the percentage distorts a bit the fact it's a small number. However, we also see the conversion rate between a complaint and a substantiated complaint is also much higher in contracted facilities. It's 54% higher. And we've chosen to report on substantiated complaints. That, I think, is what is important and what we are tracking. Next slide, please. So new this year to the directory, in part related to feedback through our resident care survey and comments about food, that we started to look at the food issue this year. So we did report in the past, and we continue to report this year, on facilities whether they contract out or not. So 24% of facilities contract out their food services, and that can be either it's prepared off-site by a contractor and brought in, or it can be prepared on-site by a contractor. But 24% of facilities are not using their own staff to prepare the food. Notwithstanding that, 87% of facilities do have their food prepared on-site. Now, what is interesting, so we looked at the average funded cost for food each day, and it's $8 per resident. But the range goes from $4.92 per resident per day funded food cost to a high of $18.44 per resident per day. Now, at the high end, at the $18.44, what you've got is a very small facility up in the Charlotte, Northern Haida Gwaii Hospital and Health Center, where there are, I think, about five residents. And so you've got very small numbers, high food costs. I think we can explain that's a bit of an outlier, an anomaly. But we've got quite a few clustered at the lower end as well. And we are going to start to look at this a little more closely, because one of the things we realize is we know what the funded food costs are. We don't know what facilities are actually, there's no mechanism to look at what they're actually spending on the raw food. And what you want to make sure is that when we're deciding what nutritional, good variety of food basket looks like and what that cost is for the food, for the ingredients, we want to make sure that, and we're funding for that, we want to make sure facilities are actually spending the money on that and it's not being diverted to other aspects of the food preparation. So we can expect to see more of that in the future. So the final slide is just contact information about this office. The presentation has given us a highlight of the highlights, if you will. I would encourage you to read the accompanying document for those who are interested in what is happening systemically on a province-wide basis. And certainly those of you who are interested in your particular facility, in your community, or where your mom and dad might be, go and look at the facility you're interested in. And I would strongly encourage you to also look at what the residents say about the facility. So I'm going to use food as an example. I went and looked at the results of the resident survey from one of the facilities with the lowest food cost, $4.92. And what was interesting is the residents in that facility, and it's about 110 beds, so it's a good size for getting a robust response on the survey, actually gave very high rate, got above average ratings on the high end of the scale. They also had more negatives, actually, both ends of the scale. But it wasn't axiomatic that this lower funded food cost resulted in residents on average reporting greater dissatisfaction with the food. And part of that is we don't know what's being spent on the food. We only know what it's being funded. And so questions arise, are we having to divert funds from other areas to supplement the food costs? And we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, and what we're seeing is cutbacks in other areas. So we're going to start to look at that a little more thoughtfully, in part because we did find that 40% of residents wanted more variety in their food than they were receiving. So that sums up the highlights from the updated directory, and I'm happy to turn it back to Frederick to manage the questions. Just a reminder, if you are queuing for a question, to press the numbers 01, and if you want to withdraw your question, hit the number sign. So over to you, Frederick.
Okay, certainly. So at the moment, we have a couple of people queuing up. So we'll just take a quick moment to grab their names. And again, just a quick reminder, 01 to queue up, and the pound sign to remove yourself from the queue. And okay. So our first question here comes from Tom Shipitka. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the presentation. Lots of good information there. Just wanted to know if there is a breakdown on the average age, the cognitive profile, and the physical profile in regards to the health authority facilities and the contractor facilities. Basically what I'm getting at is either one of those facilities on average handling more...
The short answer, Mr. Shinka, is yes, there is a breakdown, and it is in the companion document under the profile of the resident. So what we see on the physical side, measured by an ADL score of 5+, we find that in health authority owned and operated sites, 34% of residents have very high physical needs compared to 28% of residents in contracted facilities. On the cognitive performance scale, we find that in health authority owned and operated sites, 31% of residents have severe cognitive impairment compared to 29% in contracted. And when you look at what percentage is above and below the average, health authorities have 53% of residents above at the provincial average of 30% severe cognitive impairment, and contracted has 49%. We also, in the attached report, you will see the what we call the case mix index, the CMI, which is a formula to determine complexity, and you will find that in the average case mix index, 59% of health authorities have residents above that versus 43% of contracted. So right across the board, the picture that is clearly developed on using a number of indicators is that health authority facilities are caring for more complex clients than contracted.
That's great. Do I got a couple more questions here, or you got to get to another person here?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm a little confused on the direct care hours. You mentioned that 3.36 is the provincial guideline. Now, is that the same as the provincial requirement? Because I've always heard it was 3.15 hours was total, not direct care and additional care, dietary, recreational. I thought direct care was actually 2.8%, or 2.8 hours, I mean. So is 3.36 the actual provincial standard?
I'm not sure where they're getting those hours from. I've never heard of those numbers. You might be looking at something from a health authority. But it's a provincial guideline best practice. There's a question about whether it should be legislated, but at the moment it's a guideline. And it is 3.36 hours, what we call direct hours per day. And what that includes care aides, nursing, allied health professionals such as physiotherapy, occupational therapy, nutritionists, social workers, etc. It doesn't include the people who are preparing food. That's not a direct care hour. It includes the people who, what, to use old language, in my day we would call it the person who's going to touch the resident.
Okay, yeah, no, I heard the provincial actual standard was 3.15, but I'll look into that, the legislative part of it. But the last part is the incidence, the reported incidence, 24%, you said more on, there was more on the contracted facilities than the health authority. Have something to do with the fact that there's 223% more residents in contracted facilities than there are in health authority facilities. And also, I did some quick math here. The average 74 points in residents and in the contracted facilities, there's about 100 people per facility. So does that, just because it says 24% more incidents in contracted facilities, does that take into effect? Does that take into consideration that there's more people in contracted facilities?
Yes, it does. It's a 24% increase in the rate of incidents.
Okay.
So everything has been equalized by saying it's the number of incidents per 1,000 beds. So that has been equalized.
Okay, great. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Okay.
One last question. Oh, I think I got knocked out.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cindy Harnett. Please go ahead.
Hello there.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi. If you would, with the backdrop of what's happening, the decrease in antipsychotic use, could you address again, please, for me, what's happening in terms of the rate of antidepressants being used? How pressing is that need, and what exactly can be done about it?
Well, thank you for raising that, Cindy, because what has happened is that we chose a few years ago, CIHI, the Canadian Institute for Health Information, people were becoming concerned about this prolific use of antipsychotics, and so the decision was made to make a quality indicator, a measure of how many residents were taking antipsychotics without a diagnosis supporting the need for it. So some people need them. If they need them, they should get them. So this was only about who's getting them and not needing them. And
right.
We can see we are making progress, although we still have quite a ways to go, particularly in British Columbia. But another issue that I am trying to get started focusing attention on is the use of antidepressants. So right now, all we can do, because we haven't made it a quality indicator, which would allow us to more precisely match up the data, all we can do is say in a facility there are 50% of people taking antidepressants and 24% diagnosed with depression. We actually can't marry up that the people diagnosed with depression are taking the antidepressants. I think we can assume that.
Oh, I see.
But we don't know that for sure. So we may be understating. We're not overstating, but we could be understating the number of people taking antidepressants without a diagnosis of depression. And when I see what we did on antipsychotics, once we started the discussion about it, I see that we could be doing the same with antidepressants. And the challenge, of course, in a care facility is that many of the side effects from antidepressants mimic the presentation of dementia. Lethargy, confusion, challenges with walking, mobility, restriction, all sleeping, all can be attributed to dementia as well. And so we may not be recognizing that optimizing the ability, the functionality of our residents may actually be enhanced by reducing antipsychotics. And we also know better what some of the frontline therapies are to deal with some of the issues around not being able to sleep properly and so on. And so I am hopeful. These things take time, but every progress starts by calling attention to the issue. And so I hope that's what we're going to start now.
I'm sorry, can you address that again? So when you're saying it mimics the presentation of dementia, that's people on the antidepressants?
That's right. And I want to clarify. So this is some side effects for some people, right? It's not everybody.
Okay.
So when you look at what are some of the side effects of antidepressants, well, they can cause confusion, they can cause drowsiness, they can cause lethargy, seniors that can cause challenges with your gait, in other ways, the way you walk. And all of these things can cause you to be withdrawn from social activities. All of these are also some of the presenting symptoms for dementia. And so when somebody is 88 years old and on an antidepressant, and we are attributing their presentation of symptoms to dementia, how do we know what their functionality would be like if we had weaned them off the antidepressants? And part of it, now you've got me on a roll here, Cindy, is that when you look at the data around who was prescribed medications before they came into residential care, that's where it gets quite stunning. So you see that something in the neighborhood, and I want to clarify this to be quoted on it, but it's, you know, 50% of people who are prescribed antipsychotics within 7 days of admission to a care facility weren't on them in the community. And it's a stunningly high number on antidepressants as well. So what changed? And once you start on these medications, it is difficult to make the adjustments to take people off the medication. And, you know, we want, especially when you see things like the, you know, index of social engagement at 50%. Low, but you don't see 50% of people with severe dementia. Mild and moderate dementia could be misdiagnosed. Certainly mild dementia could be a misdiagnosis.
Okay. So you, in terms of getting this quality indicator, what can be done? Are you putting a call for that? And a quality indicator, what does the street speak for that? How would you explain that in a...
Well, that's out of the control of myself and the
yeah.
province. That's
yeah.
with the Canadian Institute for Health Information. And so we are starting that discussion. This is a fairly profound thing to do. It's not going to happen overnight. But hopefully we can get that discussion going. And I think the success we've seen on the antipsychotics, I think, which is to the credit of CHI-HI for making it a quality indicator, shows the power of doing it. And so we may be able to do that with antidepressants.
Okay. And on Let's Talk Day, you're not saying you're not anti any of these drugs, that it should be with a diagnosis.
That's correct. If you need, if for the 24% of the population that are depressed, diagnosed as depressed in the facilities, antidepressants may be absolutely appropriate for them. You know, the frontline therapy for mild depression is not medication. The frontline therapy for mild depression is a lot of lifestyle adaptations to begin with. And if they do not result in a lifting of the depression, then we move to a pharmacological intervention. And we're not doing that so much in the care facilities as we are in the community. But you absolutely, if you need to be on them, you should be on them.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. And as a reminder, if anybody would like to queue up for a question, you can press 01 on your telephone keypad. To remove yourself from the queue, you can press the pound sign. Our next question comes from Susan Lazarek of the Vancouver Sun. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello. I wanted to ask, is it in your mandate, first of all, generally to make recommendations on behalf of seniors about these findings and specifically about how to get, especially the contracted out facilities, to comply with hiring more staff? There hasn't been much movement since last year. What needs to be done, and are you making a specific recommendation to the government on behalf of seniors for that?
So, Susan, to answer your question, yes, part one of my legislative duties is, in fact, to make recommendations to Minister responsible for seniors. At the moment, that's the Honourable Adrian Dix, and also to service providers on improvements that can be made. One is, I just want to make a point of clarification that the contracted facilities, it's not their decision to provide lower funded the care hours. It's the health authorities in funding those facilities. So it's not for me to direct contracted facilities to raise them. It is for me to recommend to the health authorities that they increase the funding for those care hours. Now, there is another side. We have got to be in there monitoring that the money we're providing is being spent on the front lawn, but that's another issue for another day. So care hours, the government has made a commitment to raising these care hours and more precisely raising the funding for these care hours. That commitment was made about a year ago under a previous government. The current government is going to honor that commitment. There were some funding assumptions in the previous government's calculations that have not materialized in the current fiscal environment, so it presented a challenge. But and in terms of quantum, you know, depending in round numbers, it's about 110, 120 million, about 100 million, give or take, but it's every single year that funding has to be found. And I am assured by the minister and by the ministry that they are pushing money out the door, for want of a better term. It's a four-year plan. I have no reason not to believe them. And there will be evidence to support whether or not this happened when we start to look at the 2017-18 expenditures. And we won't see that until probably June of 2019. So I'm taking people at their word at the moment. They are certainly sincere in their desire to do this. We just need to have the money flow.
Okay, thank you. And about the monitoring of how much the funded food dollar is actually spent on food, has that started already? Have you asked the facilities to already provide proof that they're actually spending that money on food? Has that begun?
No, we're going to start a conversation with the health authorities because, Susan, we just started collecting these data on food costs and we published them. And I think what was striking was the range. So there's two issues. Is $8 a day per person enough or not? Maybe it is. You know, for comparison, we spend $11 a day to feed prisoners in our provincial system, but they do eat a lot more food. So maybe but it's not $8 a day in every facility. It ranges. Now, the $18 one is a bit of an outlier, but there are several that are, you know, $4, $5, $6 in what's happening there. And that, we're going to be talking to health authorities about how we're going to monitor. And frankly, on a whole lot of things, how are we monitoring the money we're giving to contracted facilities to make sure it's being spent in the way we think it's being spent?
Okay, thank you. And just one last question. On the, you mentioned that there was 406, I believe, more number of beds added since the last report. Is that keeping up with the percentage of the population that's aging? It seems like a small number. Is that part of your mandate, too, to ensure that more of these facilities are built or not torn down?
To answer your question, we do, another document we do, a monitoring report, speaks to that issue, Susan. And so we do know that there's about three moving parts here. Moving part number one is there's probably about 15% of our beds in care right now occupied by people who could live in the community if we gave enhanced supports in the community. So if we can create some capacity in the current system, by making sure the people who live there have no alternative but to live there, number one. Number two, notwithstanding that, there are definitely areas in the province where there are not enough beds. The number being created is not keeping pace with the population 75 plus. One of the big questions is, where do you draw the line on the age? I mean, in the old days, you might say your population 65 plus when people went into care at age 70. Well, the average age of the person in care has been rising. And so what population are we looking at? Is it people over 80? Is it people over 75? What's the right measure to look at the right number of beds? It's a bit unknown. But the short answer, which is now, I realize, too late to give, is we're not keeping pace.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dan Davies. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Just kind of a bit of a follow-up question in regards to the 25 or 24% higher incidences in the contracted facilities. Kind of a two-part question. I'm just wondering, has there been a correlation between that number as well as the higher complaints, the 8.9 per 1,000 beds? Is there a connection between those two that throws off that 8.9 or makes it higher?
It could be. I mean, a complaint could be issued to a health authority around issues that resulted actually in a critical incident that was investigated and substantiated. But it's a theme across the board that there are more complaints and more incidents per unit of beds in contracted sites than health authority sites.
Okay, so I guess as a follow-up then, with 24% higher incidents in contract beds and higher substantiated complaints as well as straight complaints, is there an oversight, what is the oversight that follows up on, basically follows up on this and kind of keeps this all in check? 24% higher incidence seems quite significant.
Yeah, it's a good question. And it perhaps points to a gap we have in the system, because what we have right now, we have two sort of disparate entities. We have incident reporting, which is through licensing, and their function is simply to go in to do the inspection. They're inspecting related to the standards under either the Community Care Assisted Living Act or the Hospital Act, and seeing what those standards are and whether they've been met or there's a violation. That's incident reporting. You can have an incident and you are compelled to report certain incidents, and it's not necessarily a negative reflection on the facility, and it's fixed. Complaints is a completely different stream. Complaints is, I don't like what's happening here. My mother is not getting help with her feeding, which is not actually a reportable incident under the Act, interestingly enough. And that complaint may be substantiated. Yes, there was something there. And so, a unified body that's actually looking at the overall, what I would call quality, and rating it and ranking it, that's not really happening in a systematic, uniform way in the province. We've got bits and pieces at the moment. So it is a gap.
Yeah, is there, we've looked at, or you've made a couple comparisons with other provinces. Do other provinces have something in place that looks at this, or are you aware of anything?
No, there isn't a province that has. Interestingly enough, the UK does have a body that does that, a quality council, and it looks at both care facilities and home care agencies. And so that has certainly piqued my interest.
Yeah.
In terms of oversight, and is something you might expect to hear more from my office about in the future.
Great. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kathleen Starr. Please go ahead.
Kathleen Strass from Kinsmont. Good morning, and thank you for the presentation. I have pretty much one question and just two clarifications. I was you indicated that you said seatbelt is not a physical restraint. Did I got that correct?
I believe that the Kai High is not counting the use of the wheelchair seatbelt as a physical restraint.
Okay, because I'm going to follow, because we have a few of those, and licensing certainly told me it is a restraint. So we've been coding it.
Yeah, you need to talk to Kai High about the coding on that.
Okay, thank you. The other clarification is, I thought rec therapy was a required service for complex care, so I'm very surprised it's 29%.
It's a required service, but as you know, we are asking residents about the participation in the last 7 days. And, of course, as you know, the way it's measured in the 15-minute increments and the size of the people engaged in the recreation therapy, I get feedback from facility operators and rec therapists that they think it underrepresents what's being provided because of the coding issues. The Kai High data are not perfect. Nobody's saying it is. But every facility, if you want to compare apples to apples, is using the same measurement tool. And so I also, 3.36 hours is also a requirement, and we're not meeting it. So it's so facto, just because something is a requirement, I think part of the challenge is we're finding out these things are not being met. And I think rec therapy is one of them. Not all residents will require recreation therapy. They require recreation, but not all residents would necessarily require the degree of intervention of a rec therapist.
Okay, all right. My last question is just about the antipsychotics and the comparison you made to the Prairie provinces. So we know that British Columbia has many more seniors and a lot more complex care beds than any of the Prairie provinces. People in their older years tend to retire to either the West Coast or the East Coast. So we get a lot of imports from Alberta, for sure, and Saskatchewan. We get a lot of those. And I'm just wondering on the comparison where they're using less antipsychotics, is the average age 85? The average age in my care home is 91. So I'm just wondering, are we comparing apples to apples? Because if many seniors leave Alberta and come to BC or go to Arizona, I'm not sure if they have as many seniors at the same age and the same complexity as what we have.
Well, they certainly have more in Ontario, and we're not doing as well.
You didn't mention Ontario, but you said the Prairie.
The short answer is this is a Kai High measurement, and so it is irrespective of your overall population. It's your population in residential care, and it's the profile of that population in residential care. So we know that people do live longer in British Columbia than they do in Alberta, but they also live healthier to a later age in British Columbia than they do in Alberta. So what you have to look at, a lot of the moving parts. So when you look at it, the average age doesn't tell the story. What's telling the story is aggressive behaviors, case mix index, severe cognitive impairment, and ADL function. And those are not that different across the board in any province. Relative to British Columbia. So I think we need to look at what are our practices and what is our culture, because I think that that's what's driving the antipsychotic higher use in British Columbia. I don't want to get away from the fact we are improving, but I also am cautious because I'm not the government. I'm here to advocate independently for seniors. I do not want us to become complacent about that because we are still higher, all things being equal, than Alberta, Manitoba, and Ontario.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jenny Ashton. And first, just to confirm, once again, you can press 01 on your telephone keypad to queue up and the pound sign to remove yourself from the queue. So the next question is from Jenny Ashton. Please go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First thing I'd like to say is thank you so much for doing the hard work of gathering this data. I know how hard it is, and I appreciate it greatly. Both the data for the facility-specific quick facts sheets as well as the residential care survey data. The first question I have is one, how often will this data be collected and reported on? And then the second question would be, is there a way to download this data, the QuickFacts reports off the website.
Thank you, Jamie. And I want to thank you for the appreciation, but really the people who do the heavy lifting, I just get to deliver the package, are with me in the conference call, and that's Nora Huber, who is responsible for the updated data in the directory this year, and Rob Cowan Douglas, our economist, who does a lot of the calculations on the numbers. So they really deserve the credit for the actual work in the directory. This directory is updated every year. This is the third year, so every January, so January of 2019, you will see this directory updated. We have generally maybe tweaked something or added something, received feedback, and so in 2019, we're adding a few more things as well to the directory, but that's when it will be updated. Oh, and the download. So everything can be downloaded. Now, Jamie, I warn you, the directory is 900 pages if you press print for all of the facilities. If there's a particular facility that you want to look at, you can restrict your downloading to that facility. But everything is downloadable.
Great. One last question. You said you've got 3 years' worth of this data. In the future, would there be any augmentation of this fact sheet with some longitudinal run charts?
Yes. You'll see that in the attached report when you read it, we generally have shown over the 3 years what has been the trend line. Sometimes when we've added data for the first time, we don't have that trend line yet, but we'll be starting it. So we've done length of stay, for example, by facility. And I think the average length of stay overall for the province is 800 and some odd days, so a little over 2 years. So we'll start that to see what's happening on that, and again with the food and other things. But yes, that is our intent.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you. And that was the last question in the queue.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for those of you who are left on the line. Thank you very much for joining in. And just a reminder that it will be uploaded to the website in the next day or so to listen to. A reminder, both the slides that I spoke to and the attendant report will be online. We'll probably take the slides off in a couple of days just because you need the context of the speaking to them, but the report will stay on online going forward. So I will turn it now back to Frederick to close out the conference call. Thank you, and thank you, Frederick.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes the Seniors Advocate News Conference Call. Thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.